In the 1950s, the Jamaican Census Bureau did a breakdown of all of the lawyers in the country according to their skin tone. People who were white and light, that is, people who had some black heritage that is no longer readily apparent, made up 38.8% of the lawyers. People who were olive-skinned or light brown or dark brown made up about a third of the lawyers. People who were black made up about 5% of the lawyers. And keep in mind that blacks made up a total of 80% of the Jamaican population. Do you see the extraordinary advantage that their little bit of whiteness gave the colored minority? Having an ancestor who worked in the house and not in the fields, who got full civil rights in 1826, who was valued instead of enslaved, who got a shot at meaningful work instead of being consigned to the sugarcane fields, made all the difference in occupational success 2 and 3 generations later. Daisy Ford's ambition for her daughters did not come from nowhere, in other words. She was the inheritor of a legacy of privilege. Her older brother Rufus, with whom she went to live as a child, was a teacher and a man of learning. Her brother Carlos went to Cuba and then came back to Jamaica and opened a garment factory. Her father, Charles Ford, was a produce wholesaler. Her mother, Anne, was a Powell, the same Powells who would, 2 generations later, produce Colin Powell, another educated, upwardly mobile, colored family. Her uncle Henry owned property. Her grandfather John, the son of William Ford and his African concubine, ended up as a preacher. No less than 3 members of the extended Ford family ended up winning Rhodes scholarships. If my mother owed William M. McMillan and the rioters of 1937 and Mr. Chance and her mother Daisy Ford, then Daisy owed Rufus and Carlos and Anne and Charles and John. My grandmother was a remarkable woman, but it is important to remember that the steady upward path upon which the Fords embarked began with a morally complicated act. William Ford looked upon my great-great-great-grandmother with desire at a slave market in Alligator Pond and purchased her. The slaves who were not so chosen had short and unhappy lives. In Jamaica, the plantation owners felt it made the most sense to extract the maximum possible effort from their human property while the property was still young, to work their slaves until they were either dead or useless, and then simply buy another round at the market. They had no trouble with the philosophical contradiction of cherishing the children they had with a slave and simultaneously thinking of slaves as property. William Thistlewood, the plantation owner who catalogued his sexual exploits, had a lifelong relationship with a slave named Fibba, who, by all accounts, he adored and who bore him a son. But to his field slaves, he was a monster, whose preferred punishment for those who tried to run away was what he called Darby's Dose. The runaway would be beaten, salt, pickle, lime juice, and bird pepper rubbed into his or her open wounds. Another slave would defecate into the mouth of the miscreant, who would then be gagged for 4 or 5 hours. It is not surprising, then, that the brown-skinned classes of Jamaica came to fetishize their lightness. It was their great advantage. They scrutinized the shade of each other's skin and played the color game as ruthlessly in the end as the whites did.